Hello. We're standing next to the exit from the Ratur subway station that leads to Długa Street. My name is Nitan, and I work for the Museum of the History of Polish Jews. I'm going to take you on a walk around Muranów, which before World War II was the heart of Jewish Warsaw, and where the Museum of the History of Polish Jews stands today. This district of Warsaw was described by Beata Chomontowska in her book Stacja Muranów. Muranów Station. My first apartment in Warsaw was on Elektoralna Street. It's not in Muranów, but it's nearby, and it was also part of the ghetto. I would walk to my job along the edge of Muranów. For a long time, I was afraid to enter it. I was afraid to see a scar, a reminder of the ghetto, something frightening. But one day, I did walk into Muranów, and I discovered quite friendly-looking buildings scattered among the hills. Then I started looking for some information about it, but I couldn't find any. So I decided I had to provide the information myself. What do the people who moved here in the 50s feel? Do they have nightmares? Do they even think about what used to be here? Muranów was designed as a complex made out of the debris of the ghetto that had never been done before. An interesting idea, but no one thought about the future inhabitants, how they might feel. It sounds like something out of a horror movie. It is the old Jewish district. I use this term, but one has to remember that apart from the times of World War II and the ghetto, there was never a separate area for Jews. The only Jewish district in Europe, maybe in the world, which is completely destroyed. There are only about 20 buildings left in the era of the ghetto. Usually, something remains. Here, nothing did. A completely new city was created out of debris. That was Professor Lachert's idea. It's a city within a city, sort of a palimpsest, which can be read while walking through Muranów. Walk down the cobblestone street until you get to an intersection.
The tour you're taking can be finished without using a map, but you have to follow the directions carefully. The footsteps you will hear in the background mark the tempo of the walk. If you can't or don't want to follow this pace, or you wish to make a stop to visit a shop or take a rest, don't stop the audio track entirely, simply pause it. Then resume playback when you are standing at the appropriate spot on the route.
These cobblestones remember the 1920s, times when Alfred Dublin strolled around these streets. This is how he described this part of Warsaw back then.
Jewish women walking in the crowd are wearing black wigs, black veils on top, and something like a flower on the front. On their shoulders, black shawls.
Stop at the corner and look at the street.
For me, it's strange to see a fashionably dressed man accompanied by his elegant sister walking proudly with a skullcap on his head. Families immersed in conversation, wandering along the cobblestones. Two young men wearing clean long black coats walk next to their wives, who are dressed in fashionable attire, wearing lipstick, showing a bit of Polish attitude. They're with a boy wearing a navy uniform and a cap with torpedo written on it. A Polish policeman is directing the traffic. This is the neighborhood of two nations. Girls stroll around holding hands. They don't look Jewish at all, laughing and chatting in Yiddish, and dressed in the Polish style right up to their thin stockings. Their posture is good. The men hunch their shoulders and backs, slouching.
Turn left and walk straight until you reach the corner of this building. This street, called Bohaterów Getta, or Ghetto Heroes, is quite strange. It imperceptibly recedes from the main route leading to Krasiński Garden, where it ends. It takes us behind the arsenal, that is, the building on your left-hand side, to a place where one can see the pre-war tram tracks sunken in the cobblestones. Despite the fact that so many years have passed, they are still visible. This street, usually empty and quiet, doesn't really suit its surroundings. It compels one to play with one's imagination. Bohaterów Getta Street is in fact a piece of what used to be pre-war Nalewki Street. Before 1945, Nalewki Street went further north, crossing a park which is adjoined to today's Krasiński Garden. Stop and turn so your back is turned on the arsenal. 70 years ago, in front of you, you would have seen the following. First, Nalewki 2, a four-story building which housed a department store, the so-called Simon's Passage. Next to it, the entry to a dead-end alley called Vjazd. Then, there was a second building, which was also a part of the department store, which had 6 stories, and next to it, a tenement house at Nalevki 4, which had both ordinary flats, and the headquarters of the local government and the Polish Motorcycle Association. That house was lower. It had only 3 stories and was adjoined to the entrance of the Krasiński Garden Gate. You can keep walking straight. The arsenal itself also looked different. Its facade on the side of Nalevki Street was just a plain solid wall, because back then the building housed a prison. For the same reason, there was no sidewalk along that wall, even though the street was a very busy one. On its right, not far from here, stood the house at Nalevki 15, which housed 24 shops and other commercial establishments, including 5 glove and hat boutiques. Turn left and walk around the Arsenal building. Nalevki, however, was home not just to tenement houses and shops, but also to sounds. Bernard Singer, a pre-war journalist, described the street this way.
There was a lot of shouting, which seemed the natural melody of these streets. I heard it every day in Muranov. At the Muranov market, next to every stand, there were roughly 50 of those, stood the owner's entire family, the husband, the wife, and at least 2 children. Near the stands stood vendor women with their baskets. The market shouted from dawn to dusk. It was a means of enticing customers. The merriest moment was the evening when prices dropped and people shouted even louder. Then one could cheaply buy a fish or even some fruit.
Turn left and walk to the stairs down to the subway station. Look at the blue skyscraper, the tall building closest to us. Before World War II, here stood the Great Synagogue of Tłomackie Street. It was officially opened on September 26, 1878, on Rosh Hashanah, which is the Jewish New Year. It was an enormous synagogue that could fit 2,200 people, and it was quite a lot taller than the building on the left, which before the war housed the main Jewish library and the Institute for Judaic Studies, and today is the headquarters of the Jewish Historical Institute. Stairs led to the entrance adorned with 4 huge pillars supporting the portico. On both sides of the main stairs stood 2 large menorahs that had lamps instead of candles. For several decades, the synagogue was a symbol of Reform Judaism in Warsaw. People who came here to pray were mostly assimilated, wealthy Jews. Most of the prayers were led in Polish, which was rather uncommon at the time. When the Second World War broke out, the Jewish universe that Nalevki Street and the Great Synagogue were a crucial part of began to slowly disappear. One of the turning points at the time was the Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur, that is, the Day of Atonement, of 1940. That year, the holiday was celebrated on October 12th, and on that very day, the Warsaw Ghetto was created. Stop for a moment. Adam Czerniaków, an important figure in the pre-war Jewish community and during the war, head of the Judenrat, wrote this that day in his journal. In the name of humanity, at the behest of the governor general, according to higher orders, a ghetto is being created. I've been supplied with a plan of the German district and a separate plan of the ghetto. By October 31st, displacements will be voluntary, and after that date, compulsory. It is prohibited to take furniture. 2.5 years later came the symbolic end of Jewish Warsaw. It happened on May 16, 1943, at 8:15 p.m. The Great Synagogue was blown up. After 10 days of preparations, SS-Gruppenführer Jürgen Strupp, known as the Warsaw Ghetto Executioner, pulled the trigger of the detonator, which simultaneously fired off all the explosives set inside the walls of the building. Afterwards, in a report written for Heinrich Himmler, leather-bound and in Gothic font, he triumphantly announced, "The Jewish quarter of Warsaw is no more." Use the underground passage to get to the other side of the street. The first ghetto for a Jewish community was created in Venice back in the 16th century, after the First Council of the Lateran enforced the separation of Christians and Jews. The Jewish citizens of the city were moved to Ghetto Nuovo Island. The name of the island meant the New Foundry, and had been named that after a cannon barrel factory that was on the island. That coined a new application for the word il ghetto, or ghetto, which was derived from the verb gettare, meaning to found or to smelt iron. The word began to mean a separated part of town for a specific group of people. When the Jews were moving their possessions to Ghetto Nuovo, Venetian glaziers, very famous all over Europe, had been working on a different island, Murano, for already 200 years. They, too, had been forced to move to the island, so they would have no way of sharing secrets of their craft. In the 17th century, when there were no longer any restrictions, a man from Murano named Simon Giuseppe Belotti, an architect and entrepreneur, moved to Poland. Searching for a place for his residence, he found himself in the northern outskirts of Warsaw, not far from where we're standing right now. Back then, this area served as public grazing land. It was full of green fields, ponds, moors, and islets scattered around, so it probably reminded him of his native land. He called the place Murano, after the island he came from, hence today's name Muranów. It owes its existence to a little Venetian island, just 2.5 kilometers from where the first Jewish ghetto in the world was created. Are you already upstairs on the other side? Stop for a moment next to the fountain. Jews began to settle in Muranów in the late 18th and the early 19th centuries. For over a century, the world of Warsaw Jews grew, internally polarized and diversified. That very world practically disappeared during the war under the debris of the razed ghetto. Use the stairs to get to the terrace above the entrance to the cinema. This is where the Muranów district begins. The sign above the cinema leaves no room for doubt as to where we're headed. Do you know why we need to use the stairs here? After the Great Synagogue was demolished, the Germans leveled almost the entire area of the ghetto. Several meter-tall mounds of rubble stretched to the horizon. When in 1945 World War II came to its end, Warsaw began to rebuild, and a decision was made to restore the Muranów district. It's often said that Muranów was reborn on those heaps of rubble simply out of necessity, that there was simply too much debris, and it could not be removed. That version, however, is not true. Bohdan Lacher, the architect who designed this part of the city, always stressed that he deliberately decided not to clear the rubble. He was aware that the debris contained human remains. His idea was to create a sort of pedestal, to show that the new housing project grew not out of nowhere, on a featureless land, but from the debris of the ghetto. Stand between the columns. Take a look at the city. Do you know how far the ghetto walls reached? Look left. You'll see a part of the dark greenish Intrakow skyscraper. That's where the northern border of the ghetto was. At the opposite extreme, the southern border followed Złota Street, cutting right through the piece of land where the Palace of Culture stands today. You'll have to lean over the banister a bit in order to be able to see part of the palace's spire in the space between the buildings. The eastern border of the ghetto ran along Nalewki Street, where we just came from. The western border, however, was just about a 45-minute walk away from where we are now. The ghetto was enormous. 307 hectares of residential property and 33 hectares of public property. For a time, the Jewish cemetery was also included in the ghetto. In March 1941, when the ghetto reached its highest population density, 460,000 people lived there. Turn around. It should be austere and with no adornments, no plaster. The walls should be left bare. The only aesthetic accent in the rubble concrete buildings would be the window frames. Building a memorial district means a compromise. Muranów would float on the rubble terrace like a ghost town to which the massive arched gateway would lead from the east. That's how Bohdan Lacher designed it. Walk through the gateway and stop. Look at the windows in front of you. Here, even the windows had to be different. In some of them, you'll still be able to see a three-piece window, with the middle part shaped like the letter H, and a small, horizontally hinged window between the vertical frames. Krzysztof Lachert, Bogdan's son, remembers it this way. Those windows were shaped that way out of defiance. Dad wanted to have something else than the ubiquitously applied so-called C2 standard, which meant double Swedish-style windows. That was one of the symbols of early post-war architecture. Our family anecdote, however, says that the whole thing was a present. When Dad's sister-in-law, Hannah, gave birth to her son, Lachert became his godfather. Still, he took his time buying a present for the child. What kind of godfather is this man, the family would remark. He hasn't even bought a gift for the child. Several days later, Lachert called Hannah over and said to her, "Look carefully at these houses." "The windows are weird," Hannah noticed. "They're for you. Every single one of them has your initial in them. I hope you like my belated christening present." Turn left and follow the sidewalk. Behind this gate, the future residents of this neighborhood were to find a playground, which you can see on the right-hand side, and a kindergarten entirely surrounded by plants. There was also a plan to install some sculptures designed under the supervision of the Dean of the Academy of Fine Arts, Professor František Starenkiewicz. You'll find four different types of rubble concrete buildings here: gallery access apartment blocks, stairwell apartment blocks, detached three-story houses, and 11-story towers. On the left-hand side, you'll pass the stairwell apartment blocks, that is, buildings, in which life revolves around the stairwells, surrounded by windows. Keep walking straight. The low wall you can see on the right-hand side was also an architectural element designed by Lachert. In front of you, you have the galleries, or open stories. The gallery access apartment blocks were Lachert's favorites. Such buildings dominated the blueprints of the district. He definitely had a soft spot for them. After all, a few years before the war, together with his friend, Józef Szanajca, he designed the first house of this kind for his family, which stood in Saska Kępa, district of Warsaw. Besides, the gallery access apartment blocks were economical. In the times when state-imposed standards provided only 10 square meters per person, it was a huge advantage. Gallery access apartment blocks made it possible to fit many more apartments in the same amount of space as in a traditional building, because fewer staircases were needed. Also, one shouldn't forget that there was yet more savings. The hallways didn't need to be heated. Keep following the road until you get to an intersection behind the church. This space gave exceptional possibilities for kids to play. Dr. Eva Klekot, a cultural anthropologist who was brought up in Muranów, recalls her childhood this way. There were a lot of places for children to play in Muranów. It was designed this way. Inside, there are kindergartens and schools, while taller buildings around them create safe and enclosed spaces. No one had to worry that a child might get run over by a car, since, well, there were not so many cars then, but also children did not go out on the street. We would play, and we would go from one courtyard to the other. The division between them was rather arbitrary. They were connected. But somehow we had an understanding that here was my courtyard, and the one over there was Danusia's. And when I was going off to see Danusia in her courtyard, I had to yell up to my mother and tell her I was going over to Danusia's. We were aware of some sort of borders. But the real borders were the rarely used streets, like Nowolipie and Karmelicka. Since the buildings are on hills, you had to actually climb down, cross the street, and then climb up again. Behind the church, don't turn onto the sidewalk. Walk to the small street and turn left, and after that, immediately go right, so that you walk in between the trees. Notice the numbers the buildings have. The pioneers who moved here already in the year 1950 came to live in houses which were numbered in such a way that soon it was nothing unusual to see confused visitors wandering around the neighborhood searching for the right address. Even postmen had trouble. And no wonder, given they found the block number 113 behind number 12, or discovered that number 69 adjoined to the numbers 150, 151, and 151B. When going to get their groceries, women would ask their older children to stand in the windows, because otherwise they could have problems finding their way back to their own house. These, however, were not the only problems the new residents of this neighborhood had. They were patient and persistent. They appreciated having a roof over their heads and soldiered on every day, wading through the mud to their cramped flats, overheated by the sun. On the way, they would climb heaps of sand and had to watch their steps so as not to fall into one of the holes full of lime. People, who during the war became used to the sight of trash, blood, and rubble, patiently put up with the pale pink facades and children playing around in puddles, having nowhere else to go, since the planned playground somehow never got built. There were no shops, no cafes, no sidewalks, and no phone booths. Muranów was associated with a constant construction site, and was a long way from the Venetian island. Keep walking straight. Go through the gateway in between the columns. What were the houses like inside? What awaited the new tenants were rooms narrow as tram carriages. People spent a lot of time thinking how to squeeze the little furniture they had into the space in such a way that there would be some room left for themselves and their families. People found windows and doors that wouldn't shut properly, massive gaps between the floor panels, and runs on the new plaster inside the muggy staircases. The tenants actually constructed their own ventilation ducts over the doors. Wooden planks served as bridges over ditches, and genuine traps lay covered in the snow. The publicly accessible laundry and drying rooms that were promised were also nowhere to be found. Just like the trees, bushes, and grass carefully selected by expert designers, which were supposed to be planted on the rubble terraces. There were also no attics, so people dried their laundry either inside their flats or in between the windows. Clotheslines with underwear flying would make passing between the apartment blocks in the heart of a strange big city resemble a familiar countryside landscape. In front of us lies Novolipki Street. This is where the part of Muranov designed by Bohdan Lachert ends, and where the work of his students begins. This part is slightly different. The houses on the left were still equipped with the characteristic H-shaped windows, but in the building opposite them, you'll see traditional double ones. Eva Klekot, who is also an art historian, assesses Lachert's work. I spent my happy childhood in Lachert's Muranów, so I have a lot of affection for this place. But now, when I think of it, the very idea of communal socialist housing, a pre-war idea, is a modernistic utopia. However, when we compare it with other distorted utopias of other districts of Warsaw, namely Ursynów and Targówek, it's obvious, though, that while Muranów was being created, the individual was not forgotten. It is the utopia with a human face. Novolipki is one of the few streets that not only didn't have its name changed after the war, but also did not change its location. Several hundred meters from here, on the left-hand side, you can see the towers of St. Augustine Church. It was one of the very few buildings that was not demolished after the ghetto was destroyed. It even appears in a famous photograph taken just after the war. It was meant to be black and white, but turned out gray. It shows the emptiness of the grid of streets cleared of rubble. The only contrast is the black building in the corner of the picture, a neo-Gothic Christian church. That's St. Augustine's. When you reach the street, stop for a moment and listen. Look up to the left, above the buildings. You'll see the tower of a church. One block away from here, there used to be one of the busiest intersections in the area. Listen to its description by Jacek Laoczak, who specializes in the history of pre-war and wartime Muranów.
Po tej południowej stronie, czyli tej, na której właściwie teraz stoimy, była słynna restauracja Schulza.
On the southern side of this intersection, the side that we're standing on now, there was a famous restaurant called Schulz. It was established before the war, but was still open in the ghetto. Concerts were organized there. One of the singers was Marysia Eisenstadt. She used to be called the Nightingale of the Polish Ghetto. She was very young, only 18. Her father was the choir master in the great synagogue on Tłomackie Street. She sang songs by Schubert, Mozart, French songs, and Jewish songs that would touch hearts and were a sentimental reminder of what was before the war. She only became famous in the ghetto. People loved her. She was very popular. And one could say that she was used a lot, as she was constantly performing in many places. And right next to her, Vera Gran, Diana Blumenfeld, the great ghetto divas. So Marysia sang there, on the corner of Karmelicka and Novolipki streets. And on the other side of the street, also in the corner building, lived Chaim Aron Kaplan. Before the war, he was an educator and a teacher. He ran a Hebrew school and wrote textbooks. He started writing a diary before 1939 and did not stop after the outbreak of the war. It was written day by day till January 1943, when Kaplan disappeared during the second liquidation action. But before that, he managed to smuggle his diary out of the ghetto. He wrote it on scrolls of paper. His friends took it out of the ghetto, scroll by scroll. And so it survived, and is a very important document now. He saw, for example, a dramatic scene when one of the Jewish policemen caught some old lady and put her on a rickshaw that would take her to the Umschlagplatz. Jewish policemen had to bring five so-called heads daily, five people to the Umschlagplatz every day. If they did not, they were punished. It was them or their families that were taken to the trains. Now walk towards the street and look left. Can you see the closest intersection with Karmelicka Street? This is the intersection that Jacek told you about. Now look right. Here used to be the headquarters of Mały Przegląd magazine, or Little Review. This magazine was created by Janusz Korczak, a famous Polish pedagogue. It was created entirely by children, and for children, but still, there were many writers walking in and out of the building. Okay, let's go. Go in the direction of the Litter Review office. There's a crosswalk to your left. Use it. On the other side of the street, you may notice a yellowish-orange gateway. Do you see it? There used to be a building where a certain policeman used to live.
Pułkownik Józef Szeryński, przed wojną, zastępca komendanta...
Before the war, Colonel Józef Szeryński was deputy chief of the Polish police in Lublin. It was the highest rank a Polish Jew could attain at the time. Later he became the commander of the Jewish ghetto police. When the Jewish combat organization squads were conducting sentences on traitors and collaborators, that is, on ghetto police chiefs as well, a man in a police cap knocked at the door of Szeryński's house, which was right here in Nowolipki 10. When the colonel opened the door, the man took out his gun and shot Szeryński in the face. Szeryński survived the murder attempt, but was injured. The injury was unfortunate. The scar caused a grotesque grimace on his face, which was gnarled into some kind of grotesque smile. And that is how Szeryński walked around the ghetto, with this smile. Just imagine. And then came the second liquidation action in January 1943. After the second action, Szeryński committed suicide. A group of doctors gathered in his apartment to help him. They performed a blood transfusion. They tried to help him, but ultimately he died. And this was the end of the commander of the Jewish ghetto police.
Komendant policji w getcie.
Turn left. The mural you can see there now was made in memory of Ludwig Zamenhof. He created Esperanto, which was meant to be a separate, easy, and universal language. His intention was to create a new civilization where believers of different religions could treat each other with respect and tolerance. You can pause the recording and take a look. Cross the street. Turn left and follow the sidewalk. This is one of the most important places for Beata. A funny anecdote is connected with this place.
Mierzenie okien w okrągłym podwórku zlecono pierwszej Muranowskiej Brygadzie Kobiecej. Brygady zadanie jednak przerosło.
Measuring the windows in the courtyard was assigned to the 1st Women's Brigade of Muranów. However, the task proved to be too hard for them. Stanisław Szurmak, engineer and the architect of the building, recalls that they were measuring and measuring, swearing like sailors, but nothing added up. To make things easier for them, theodolite, a special measuring tool, was brought to the construction site, but to no avail. After a few attempts, Szurmak had mercy on them and took the measurements himself. The ladies watched him, pretending to pay attention, but they had their own opinion about the matter. For a long time now, they had had a bone to pick with Szurmak. When the job was done and he was getting ready to leave, he told the women that he sure would remember them. He couldn't suspect it, but they would remember him well, too. One autumn evening, it was getting dark, but the working day was not yet over, when Szurmak arrived at the site for inspection. He parked his car by Zamenhofa Street and started slowly walking towards the courtyard. He was hoping to catch the ladies being lazy. The full moon was rising over the arched roof. It was quiet, suspiciously quiet, since the acoustics of this place were extraordinary. There were no shouts, no laughter, not even swear words that the woman often used. Walk through the gateway and stop.
Ta cisza zaniepokoiła go, choć w zasadzie była po jego myśli. Widać, jednak nie pracują.
This silence made him uneasy, although it was exactly what he expected. Clearly, the girls were not working. He jumped over a few steps to the courtyard, cast a glance on the tools, and looked up. And there, in an even row around him, countless full moons shone brightly against the unfinished window frames. Pink and pale, firm and wrinkled, all of them sticking out of dropped pants. They were shaking, jumping, moved by the laughter that was slowly rising over the courtyard. It was what Muranov's new man had to say to engineer Szurmak about social justice. This place was called simply a circle by its designer, Stanisław Szurmak, and okrąglak by the people. In total, it houses close to 1,000 apartments. Their layout was designed in accordance to specialists' advice, so that they could be as bright and airy as possible. Continue walking straight. No one-room flats, only two or three rooms, and attention to detail. According to the plans, the facades were to be finished in a neoclassical style associated with old Warsaw architecture. Four porticos and the front are made entirely of stone. The base, balconies, and window frames are carved in sandstone, and the rest is covered with stucco. It looked like it was going to be perfect, but the directives from the Central Committee started to arrive. Cut the costs of the construction by 15%. Add dark kitchens. So instead of the concrete floors in the cellars, they used clay. Instead of a balcony in each apartment, they chose a poor substitute, floor-to-ceiling French windows with a railing on the outside. They said no only to the dark, windowless kitchens. And they won, although such kitchens were already becoming fashionable. Nobody opposed the bomb shelters, though, because they were mandatory under every building. After all, the Cold War was on. Walk diagonally to the left through the small park. Approach the intersection. The Okrąglak was built in one of the successive stages of the construction of Muranów. It differs from the buildings erected during the first stage, mainly the gallery-assessed apartment blocks and traditional blocks of flats. The young residents of the Okrąglak listened to the hits of the day. Among the tunes flowing from the radios, one could hear Natasha Zelska's voice. Although her songs were very popular in Poland, she moved to Israel in 1963 and finished her career. One of her favorite songs was Kasztany, or Chestnuts. Listen to how Natasha sang.
Włosy masz jak kasztany i kasztanowy masz oczu blask. Gdyśmy chodzili razem, kochany, wśród złotych liści parku i gwiazd, wiatr trząsł kasztany pod stopy gradem. Mówiłeś żegnaj i drżał ci głos, lecz wszędzie miła, dokąd pojadę, zabiorę sobą tę złotą noc.
Stop at the lights. Look at the buildings on the other side of the street. Imagine that it's the middle of a certain autumn day in 1952. There are no buildings around, only an empty area full of heaps of rubble piled along the Wodki Street, nowadays called General Anders Street. Among the piles of crushed bricks and ruins of the destroyed buildings of the ghetto, one could make out 30-meter-tall fire ladders, sticking out with lamps burning on the top. From the opposite bank of the Vistula River, the architects Stanisław Brukalski, Stanisław Szurmak, and his wife Anna watched the ladders through the binoculars. They liked what they saw. The height of the planned buildings, the same as that of the ladders, won't disrupt the panorama of the old town. The decision is made. We're going to build it. Look at the corners of the buildings. According to the plans, 12 floor towers were supposed to stick out here. They were supposed to announce to passers-by, "Watch out! You're entering the district of Stalin's fortified palaces." Up to the fourth floor, they were supposed to be decorated with stone facing, higher parts covered with stucco. Window frames were to be carved in sandstone. The walls of the building on the western side of the street were to have balconies to break their monotony. It was planned so the residents would not have to leave the palace walls without any serious reason, like in a real castle. Everything would be within their reach. It was an ambitious plan, but financial cutbacks only allowed for half of it to be carried out. Still, the specific socialist realist grand scale remains. Cross on Jelewicza Street. Janina Baumann and her husband, Zygmunt, now a world-famous professor of sociology, moved into one of these buildings. She used to live nearby in a two-room apartment in an annex at 15 Leshno Street when she was 13, and her last name was still Levinson. Her parents got this apartment from their Christian friend in exchange for her uncle's flat, which remained within the walls of the ghetto. Turn left and pass under the pillars. One of the rooms was painted yellow. The corridor was a pea green, and the second room was blue. That's how Janina remembered the flat, and she described it in her book, Winter in the Morning. The flat to which she moved in with her husband was bright. It was on the third floor and had an elevator. It had four rooms, three of which were tiny, and one which was bigger. It also had two balconies. The other buildings along the boulevard had elevators, but did not have balconies. To us, it felt like a palace, Janina wrote later. Neighbors? Mrs. Bauman recalls them. On the second floor, just below our flat, lived a police major with his family. He must have hated us, because from time to time he would wake us up in the dead of the night, knocking on the ceiling. The next morning he would call us and shout at us that we were extremely noisy at night, and that we wouldn't let him sleep. Turn right. Or he would come upstairs and yell, claiming that we had flooded his flat. As both charges were totally unfair, we suspected that he was mentally ill. But still, we didn't feel at ease at home. We started to wear soft slippers, keep the children quiet, and asked our women friends to take off their high heels when they came to visit. We even made sure to turn off the water, just in case. Turn left. There's a lot of information on the history of Muranov on the internet. On internet forums, one can find Muranov called the Free Kingdom of Muranov, or FKM for short, and sometimes the Great Kingdom, because it covers quite a big area of downtown Warsaw. Turn right and get closer to the street. An attentive reader of such discussion groups will instantly notice that the history of this kingdom is divided into three eras. The prehistoric era, linked to its former residents, the Golden Age, divided into several stages, some better and some worse, which has lasted since World War II, and the approaching new era. Listen to what Jacek Leoczek has to say about this street, and take a seat on the bench. We walk between the courtyards and we reach the street, which is called Nalewki now. But why here? We know that it used to be somewhere else. It has no connection to the pre-war Nalewki street. However, the street on which we are standing right now is where Gęsia Street used to be. This first part of Gęsia Street used to be full of cotton storehouses, wholesalers. It was always crowded and very dynamic. Now the pre-war metropolitan Gęsia is locked in the quiet courtyard between some buildings and squares. It is absolutely and dramatically different from what used to be. The kingdom's prehistory usually comes back in the form of spine-chilling stories or excavations, for nearly everyone dug and searched. Even a famous Polish actor, Marek Konrad, recalls. We dug up several things, pots, toys, pieces of furniture. When we found something, we'd say, it's Jewish. Get up from the bench, approach the street, and turn left. When one of the residents of Muranov decided to plant a tree she had received as a wedding gift, under her block of flats, soon a small group of local seniors gathered close by. They would keep their distance, but would watch every movement of the shovel digging into the ground. It seemed as if they still believed in the stories about hidden Jewish treasure. And the first half of the Golden Age is remembered with tenderness. Oranjada, an orange fizzy drink in a capped bottle, bought at the grocer's, the taste of Proustian Madeleine cakes. Though in Muranów, instead of reading Proust, people would rather go dancing in the Nowolipie district, or make one's way to the first Warsaw concert of a famous Polish band called Czerwone Gitary, or Red Guitars, in the Wuzet Cafe near the Muranów Cinema. During heat waves, people used to take a dip in the nearby fountain, and the entrance to the Okrągła from Zamenhof Street was carefully avoided, especially at night, because it was where the most dangerous gang would gather, led by policemen's daughters and sons. But there was something that united the Golden Age with the prehistorical era, and will probably link it to the new era as well. The Polonia Sports Club. FKM was always a fan of the Polonia football team, whose stadium is close by. But the residents of Muranów, from its golden age, were also united by the memories brought by the monument in front of us. Ewa Krekot remembers the Kleitz. I remember this place as a large open area where we used to play as kids, and especially liked to fly kites. The first time I was here, I must have been here with my mother and my older brother. And of course, he was flying kites, and I was only cheering him on. There were pebbles around the ghetto monument, so to fly kites it was actually better to go to Gęsiówka, where grass was growing. Kids from the Okrąglak also used to visit the monument. They used to stop at the spacious square where bus number 170 finished its route. Turn right and follow the sidewalk in front of you. Sometimes, nicely dressed people would pile out of buses. They laid wreaths at the monument, chatted in foreign languages, and handed out authentic American chewing gum in rustling wrappers to the kids who hung around. Marlene Dietrich also visited. She stood there with an armful of flowers. In the pictures taken that day in January 1964, Marlene got out of the car and crossed the square with flowers in her arms. She didn't look like a great star, a sex symbol, an idol of the masses. In a sheepskin coat, winter boots, and a headscarf, she looked more like a hard-working woman from a socialist country. The only trace of stardom was that perfect makeup on her face twisted with cold and tears. Willy Brandt, the former chancellor of Germany, also stood here. In pictures from 1970, he's kneeling in his long black coat on the stone stairs in front of the monument. When he landed in Warsaw on his first official visit to Poland, he was told that the present Polish government didn't want any ceremony. He was to just nod his head after laying a wreath, and that was to be it. He therefore didn't plan on making any momentous gestures. Not until he was sitting in the car heading to Muranów did he realize that he had to do something, as he explained afterwards to his surprised wife. The next day, pictures of Chancellor Willy Brandt kneeling, his head down, in front of the monument to the ghetto heroes were published all around the world. In Poland, only the Yiddish magazine Volksstimme printed them. The photograph was censored in other Polish papers. In all the photographs, Brandt appears against the background of a gray apartment block with somewhat darker balconies. Look at the building on the right. Those are the balconies from the pictures. Stop for a moment and look at the monument. It is the monument to the ghetto heroes. On the side where flowers are laid at official ceremonies, you can see a bronze sculpture of men, women, and children, titled The Fight. It shows the heroic fight of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. The figures are holding bottles full of gasoline, guns, and grenades in their hands. On the other side, the one we are facing right now, there's a stone relief showing the suffering and martyrdom of women, the innocent, children, and the elderly. It is titled The March Towards Extermination. There is a trilingual inscription on the monument in Polish, Yiddish, and Hebrew. The Jewish nation to its fighters and martyrs. Let's continue walking straight ahead. The same block in the background can also be seen on pictures of countless U.S. presidents, from Jimmy Carter to Bill Clinton laying flowers at the monument, Pope John Paul II, Soviet cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin, and the Dalai Lama also visited the place. Madonna, the U.S. pop star, who assumed the name Esther and claims to study Kabbalah, also wanted to come, but she was too busy preparing for her Warsaw concert. She sent her children instead, Lourdes and Rocco. The paparazzi took their pictures as they were looking at a map of the ghetto. A dark-haired teenage girl wearing sneakers and a leather jacket, with her hair done in a ponytail, and a boy wearing white, dressed casually. Only the company of a broad-shouldered bodyguard distinguished them from Polish youth passing by. All those people who came here and still come to lay flowers at the monument want to commemorate the Jewish fighters. Cross Lewartowski Street at the crosswalk and go straight ahead. Do you remember the date May 16th, 1943? The day when the Great Synagogue was blown up? Before that, on a spring morning, on the eve of the holiday of Passover, April 19, 1943, at about 6 o'clock in the morning, the first Molotov cocktails were thrown and the first shots were fired at the SS units entering the ghetto on Nalewki Street. The shots were fired by the fighters from the Jewish Combat Organization. They only had a couple of guns and a dozen or so Molotov cocktails. After 3 hours of fighting, the Germans retreated, taking their wounded. The uprising began. The Warsaw Ghetto Uprising was the first urban uprising in occupied Europe. About 1,000 or so poorly armed fighters had no chance to win, but still fought. Look at that small stone block. This is the monument to Shmuel Zilboim, a politician of Bund, a Jewish anti-Zionist leftist party. Stop for a moment. Take a closer look. On May 13, 1943, right after the fall of the ghetto uprising, Zilboim committed suicide in London. It was his way to protest against the inaction of the Allies against the genocide of the Jews. He left a letter in which he wrote,
"I can't find peace. I can't live while the remains of the Jewish nation in Poland, which I represent, are exterminated."
Continue walking straight.
"My comrades in the Warsaw Ghetto died in their last heroic flight. I wasn't destined to die the way they did, together with them, but I belong to them and their mass graves. By my death, I want to express the strongest protest against the inaction with which the world watches and allows the extermination of the Jewish nation."
Cross the intersection diagonally, heading towards the small green square surrounded by trees. Get closer. It is a famous place at Miwa Street. Not far from here, there is a school which used to be named after Józef Wieczorek, a communist activist from the Upper Silesia region. He was a miner, so Miner's Day was the most celebrated among numerous school holidays. On December 4th, the students used to march through Miwa Street wearing miners' uniform hats made during arts and crafts lessons. Then they would go sledding, still in their hats, on a hill nearby. The ride was short but exciting, as the hill was small but steep. Climb the hill. Back then, just as today, there was a stone with a memorial inscription at the top of the hill. Older boys from the neighborhood used to come here to prove their strength. They didn't pay attention to the inscription. The weight of the stone was all that mattered. And the satisfaction from knocking it over and pushing it down the slope to the bottom of the hill, as well. Then a construction team would arrive and pull it up to the top, and the game would start all over again. Look around. This hill is also called Anielewicz's Mound, or Anielewicz's Bunker. There used to be a tenement house here before the war, at 18 Miwa Street. A bunker was created in its basement during the war. In the last days of the uprising, a group of civilians and several dozen people from the Jewish Combat Organization were hiding here. Among them was the last leader of the uprising, only 24-year-old Mordechai Anielewicz. Take a look at the stone. The inscription on it says,
"In this place, on the 8th of May, 1943, the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising leader, Mordechai Anielewicz, died as a soldier, together with the staff of the Jewish Combat Organization and several dozen of the Jewish resistance fighters. They died in the battlefield fighting against the German occupiers."
You can walk down the slope. On May 8, 1943, probably due to betrayal, the bunker was surrounded by the Germans and Ukrainian troops which collaborated with them. Some of the people hiding in there, mainly civilians, left the bunker. The members of the Jewish Combat Organization, who decided to stay inside, committed mass suicide. After the war, exhumation was not done at Miwa 18. The tiny hill at the heart of the city is still the grave of around 100 people. Walk onto the street and turn right. At the bottom, there's a statue with an inscription in Polish, English, and Hebrew, and has the 51 names of Jewish insurgents whose identity has been confirmed. Cross the street and follow Miwa Street to the right. The name of the street in Polish means nice, pleasant, darling, or lovely. Władysław Broniewski described it as follows. "Lovely streets, not lovely at all. Don't go there, my lovely, to stroll. Austere buildings, buildings all around. Their floors tower far above the ground. They wander ahead and crawl, they follow, struck with pain and worry and sorrow." One could say that the street has never been a pleasant place. Each year, during the anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, After the wreaths are placed at the monument of the ghetto heroes, people come here. At noon sharp, all the sounds fade away, and then you can only hear Kaddish in the memory of the dead. And sometimes someone will hum a partisan song. Listen to Zognit Kein Mol, performed by Chava Alberstein.
Zognit Kein Mol, as du gehst dem letzten Weg, Himmeln bleiene verstellen blaue Teg, kommen wird doch unser ausgebänkte Schor, Sveta poigt an unser Trott, mir sennen do. Kommen wird doch unser ausgebänkte Schor, Sveta poigt an unser Trott, mir sennen do. Von grünem Palmenland bis Land von weißen Schnee, wir kommen on mit unser Pein, mit unser Weh. Ohne wo gefallen, se sa spritz von unser Blut, sprotzen wird dort unser Gwure, unser Mut. Ohne wo gefallen, se sa spritz von unser Blut, sprotzen wird dort unser Gwure, unser Mut.
If it wasn't for the buildings on the right-hand side, another Muranov monument could be visible from here. It is the Umschlagplatz. Umschlagplatz means reloading point in German. There used to be a rail station here. When on July 22, 1942, the liquidation of the ghetto began, Jews were deported from here to the Treblinka extermination camp. It is estimated that during 2 months, 300,000 Warsaw Jews were deported from here. To commemorate them, on the inner wall of the monument, there are inscriptions of 400 of the most typical Polish Jewish names, in alphabetical order, from Abba to Jana. Even though we cannot name all of those who were killed, we can at least do it symbolically. It commemorates the victims of the Warsaw Ghetto. If you want to see the monument once you finish the walk, walk down Karmelitska Street to Stawki Street, where the Umschlagplatz monument stands. For various people, Muranów means different things. Jacek Leociak. Muranów is my homeland. I was born here. I was raised here. I lived here. And later it became my research field, a ground for excavations, one could say. Ewa Klekot.
Dla mnie Muranów to tylko Lachertowski Muranów. Oczywiście wiem.
For me, Muranów only means Lachert Muranów. Of course, I know that there are other buildings created later, and they're also part of Muranów. But for me, it's only the old part. These special kind of buildings in a very special urban structure. These buildings that close around us on all sides, creating a safe space. Inside, of course, there are other buildings, squares, playgrounds, kindergartens, sports fields. Beata Chomontowska. It is my place in Warsaw. When I walk around Muranów, I sometimes feel a warp of time and space. There are places and moments when it's hard not to think about what was here before. When you reach the street, turn left and follow the bike path. Ewa Klekot sees two main ways of talking about Muranów.
Każdy ma swój Muranów. Jest oczywiście taki Muranów, który próbuje się znarratywizować.
Everybody has their own Muranów. It's trying to find its own story. Surely the prevailing narration is about the remembrance of the ghetto. I think that for most people who don't live in Muranów, it is the place where the ghetto used to be.
Myślę, że dla zdecydowanej większości mieszkańców Muranowa.
Whereas for people who do live here, they don't connect it with the ghetto, and if they do, it's secondary.
Albo jest terenem getta wtórnie. I na przykład dla mnie jest wtórnie, dlatego że moje pierwsze 10 lat życia co najmniej.
For example, for me it is secondary, because for at least the first 10 years of my life, I didn't know about the ghetto, and I had a very happy childhood.
Bardzo szczęśliwe dziecięce życie, zabawy i tak dalej.
Cross the street and walk towards the big glass building. You'll get to Willy Brandt Square, named after the German Chancellor, who knelt in front of the Monument to the Ghetto Heroes, a very meaningful gesture. On the left-hand side, you can see a memorial in stone to honor that moment. The unusual glass and copper-covered building is the Museum of the History of Polish Jews, where I work. Jacek Leociak explains the symbolic meaning of this location.
To muzeum jest usytuowane w centrum getta warszawskiego.
The museum is situated in the very center of what was the Warsaw Ghetto. This unity of time and space is underlined by the fact that the building is where the old Zamenhofa Street used to be. This street was a boulevard of death in the ghetto. People who were led to the Umschlagplatz from all parts of the ghetto would all meet here and walk together straight to the Umschlagplatz.
I szli już jedną, już jedynie możliwą drogą prosto do Umschlagplatzu. Muzeum nie jest muzeum Holokaustu, tylko jest muzeum historii.
This is not the museum of the Holocaust. It's the museum of the history of Polish Jews. But this history reaches its climax and becomes thicker during the war, with the ghetto and its liquidation. So this is really the only place where this museum could be created. The museum building was designed by Finnish architect Rainer Malamäki. The architect wondered, what could be built in Muranów? A ghetto memorial? Everyone followed that line of thinking. Nathan Rappaport built a memorial, the monument to the ghetto heroes. Bohdan Lachertz built another kind of memorial. The museum should also be a monument of sorts, although more modern. That's what I thought, said the architect. Lachert's vision of recalling the tragedy of the Holocaust, building on the debris of the ghetto, was very expressive. It was distinctive. Its significance was in the invisible history of the city, which was brought to light and would not be forgotten. Rappaport's project is very literal. It's like a scream. The fighters are twisted in dramatic poses. When I first walked around the monument, said the architect, it was early spring. The snow had melted away, but the grass was still last year's. It was crushed. It was a dirty green and brown. The branches were bare, and they could not hide the gray color that invaded the landscape from all directions. The gray color of the buildings and streets, the pale sun behind the heavy clouds, the gray granite of the monument. That was my first time in Muranów. I didn't know yet what I wanted, but I felt I knew what I wanted to avoid. Whatever was to be created in the middle of the square should not be made of concrete, even though concrete is a fashionable material used in construction of upscale museums. It suited Rome, Berlin, Lille, Vaduz, but it doesn't belong here. This place required light. Yes, the new museum was born out of the need for light. If you want to visit it, walk around the building. The entrance is on the other side. I'll say goodbye for now, but I hope to see you inside.